Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is April 4th, 2017, and I am sitting in a cruise ship. This is the first time I will have ever done a podcast from a cruise ship, maybe the last, who knows. And I am sitting here with Adam Taggart and G. Edward Griffin. This is just an extraordinary moment to be able to capture. And Adam and I have been on something called the Summit at Sea, where Ed is faculty, I'm faculty, Adam's faculty, and we've been presenting to a really curious group of people. Ed and his wife Pat and I and a number of other people had just a magic dinner last night. The conversation went everywhere. There was really no topic that could be left off the table because everything was up for grabs. We went pretty far, didn't we?
We went pretty deep.
I think by the time the staff was clearing every other table and sort of looking at us and wondering when we were going to go, you posed the question, so what is the meaning of existence? We'd finally gotten to it.
We finally got to the base, to the basement, didn't we?
Oh, so Ed, this is a real pleasure for me because obviously Creature from Jekyll Island was a book that really, if I hadn't read this, my seminal work in my life, The Crash Course, which is arguably the hardest, most complete work I've ever done, and I have a PhD, and I will tell you I did more work, more concentrated to get The Crash Course out, but it started with this book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which I remember exactly where I was when I was reading it. We were at our summer place in Maine. It's on an island. There's very little electronic communication there, so I have books. Somehow this one came to me. I can't remember how I got it. But anyway, this was my summer book, and my poor wife, I was yelling out every other page, like, you won't believe this, right? And she was like, oh, stop already, you know? And she will tell the story and say it pretty much ruined her summer vacation for her, and then next year she read it.
Oh.
And she was doing the same thing back. She's like, oh, my God, you... But it was the learning how money, the mandrake mechanism, money creation, you know, having had an MBA, having spent time in the business world, having gone through more education than anybody should, and not having run across such a simple concept. That's where it first dawned on me that there was a serious sin of omission in my educational upbringing. Sometimes they'll tell you lies, but sometimes they don't tell you stuff. This is one of those cases, I think, money creation. Tell us about when you were researching this book and coming across money creation and what it took for you to unearth that, and whether you found even otherwise maybe people at the Fed who should know, who didn't know. It was just, for example, just 2 years ago, I think, Bank of England came out with a paper, a research paper, and they said, oh, my God, money's loaned into existence. You remember that one?
No kidding, really.
Remember that one, Adam?
That was a good one. The Bank of England, huh?
Yep.
No, oh, they'd made that great discovery.
They did. And it was a research paper, and it splashed, and people were like, we did not know this. I'm not kidding.
That's hard to believe, isn't it? But no, it's really not hard to believe. That's where you come around to it, because, as you said a moment ago, it's omission, but the question is, why is it omitted? Is it omitted because of somebody made a mistake?
Mm-hmm.
They were ignorant? Or was it omitted because it was designed to be omitted? And so when you really get into it and you understand how the mechanism skews the whole economic system in favor of just a few people, mm-hmm. or certainly a class, I like to call the financial oligarchy, well, then you realize there's incentive to be deceptive about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's no greater incentive than money, you know. Money is power. Money is, you can do it. Anything you want to with money, almost. And so if you have your hand on that lever of power and you think that the way to keep your hand on that lever forevermore is to not let anybody know that there even is a lever, why, then you're motivated to conceal that fact. And so reluctantly, I think most people come to the realization that this is by design, that we don't know much about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've given talks all over the United States and the world, but I ask a question pretty routinely, which I forgot to ask at this one. But the question is, how many of you learned about how money is created in the banking system in your schooling? And to date, I've had zero hands go up, although one guy at our website said, oh, I learned that out of, you know, all the thousands of people who come to the website, one person claims to have been taught this at one point, but this was back in the 70s. So maybe this was taught at one point. But certainly it's absolutely not taught. And a good friend of mine, her son, when he was in the sixth grade, taught this, went across the crash course and then taught this to his sixth grade class using Snickers bars, right? And the class was outraged. Like, that's totally unfair, right? So it's not a hard concept intellectually. But
no,
it's almost universally not taught.
Yeah, the hardest part of it for me, and I think that's where this is going in my my own epiphany on all this, the hardest part for me was to realize that it was actually as simple as it was. Mm-hmm. Because I was looking for a very complex mechanism. And I couldn't believe at that time that there would be deliberate deception in the system. So I was working on the false assumption that everybody in the system was doing their best to make it work on behalf of mankind and on behalf of society. And so everything that went wrong is in terms of, oh my goodness, we made a mistake here. You know, we have to learn from this mistake. I couldn't entertain the idea that these were not mistakes at all, and that the goal was not to benefit mankind at all. And so where we would sometimes say, well, look, the Federal Reserve System is failing to meet its goals because it said its goals were to stabilize the economy and to preserve purchasing power and all of that sort of thing. And finally, I came to the realization, no, those are not its goals. If we understand what its goals really are, then it's not failing at all. It's succeeding amazingly well. And most people, like I, found that an impossible assumption, and we couldn't get over that. I couldn't get over it for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I just had to give up and say, well, that's it, folks. Let's get back to reality now and take it from there.
Well, let's talk about that reality for a second, because I consider you and I in the same business in the sense that it's just, here's some data, here's some facts, right? The Creature from Jekyll Island is nothing but a forensic examination of a period of time. Here's some facts. Some people got together and showed up in an island and crafted a secret deal that, surprise, really benefited them.
Yeah.
And really
<Big surprise. laughs>
at the expense of other people. So this is the thing most people don't understand, is that the Federal Reserve, the way it's all packaged and sold, and you've got Janet Yellen now, all grandmotherly, and all of this and that, is that the Federal Reserve cannot create real prosperity, but they can transfer it from one group to another. They're a transfer agency, not a wealth creation agency, although people confuse that because we say, if you create money, you're creating wealth. Not the case. They're really just transferring, as every central bank is, not to pick on the Fed overly here, but I think they're all constructed the same, which is, it's a large harvesting mechanism. And I don't know any other way to look at it now, but people are having their wealth harvested and transferred from the many to the few. But it's such a tiny few.
Yes, it is. Amazingly a small group, isn't it? And therein lies one of the great needs for the confidentiality, shall we say, or the secrecy of the whole movement. And it's also one of the points that's hard to accept. How is it possible that so few can control so many? And anyway, it's a challenge, and it's a great story. When I stumbled into it, quite frankly, I stumbled into it. Many years ago, you know how old I am. I go back before the printing press. certainly before the internet. Anyway, I had no idea about any of these things, and really not much interest in it either. But I became aware that I wanted to communicate something. I became very concerned about the United Nations, for example. You talk about taking the red pill and waking up to reality. That was my first epiphany, that the United Nations, which I had been taught in school and through the media influence, I'd been convinced that the UN was our last best hope for peace. Now, we're talking back in the 1950s, 1960s now. So when I ran across information about the UN being something other than that, and that it wasn't really in the interest of peace at all, it was in the interest of using the fear of war as a motivator to drive people into a world government which was based on a totalitarian principle. But the totalitarian principle was kept sort of underneath wraps. You didn't get to see that unless you really went exploring. And all you got to see was all the propaganda about peace and how we can put an end to war and how we can put an end to disease if we just have medical care delivered to all the third world countries, and you know, all of the stuff that you think, oh, this is wonderful, let's do this. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Anyway, so I was aware of that, and so I was interested in conveying to others what I had discovered, and I decided I would make some little documentary films. That's what I was trained to do. I went to school in the field of communications, and I had worked in a television station. I've been involved in filmmaking. So this was my chance to put to work the skills that I had learned for something that I believed in. So that's where my track was back in those days. And I thought, well, all right, what will my next little film be? And I said, well, what's important looking around? Well, everything's pretty important, but money sounds pretty important to me. And I thought, what a shame that we have this thing called inflation. What a shame that a person works hard for a dollar, puts it away, saves it, and then when it comes time to retire, the dollar is worth 3 cents or a nickel or something. What a shame. Why is that? And I really didn't know, but I thought, I'm going to find out. So I started to do a little research, and of course, any time you get on the topic of inflation, you cannot help it. All roads lead to the Federal Reserve System or the central bank, whatever the country may call it. The mechanism by which money is created. Mm-hmm. And it's a question of supply and demand. And I'm learning all the way. I'm hoping I can come up with the answer so I can explain it to others.
Now, Ed, when was this?
Well, we're talking about my opening interest on that topic was probably about 1965, mm-hmm. around in there. Give or take a year, I think. Mm-hmm. So I pulled together a lot of research. I had a couple of boxes full of research and books, and I did some interviews, lots of recordings. Things in those days were not so easy to, as I say, there's no internet, so you have to go to the library where they have books on shelves and read them.
Some
and check
guy
them
named
out.
Dewey was involved. I don't know. It's...
yeah, so it was a slow process. But it was a thorough process. You know, you really got it when you went through all that rigmarole. So I got this information together, and other things came up, and I put it aside. I really never did produce that mm-hmm. documentary. Mm-hmm. But I had my toe in the water. And some years later, I think it was about 5 or 6, 7 years later, a little group in Pasadena, California, it was a study group, run by, you've heard about the little old ladies in tennis shoes, you know. Uh-huh. This was the real thing. These were some little old ladies in Pasadena, and no, they didn't wear tennis shoes, at least not at the meeting, but I'm sure they did around the house. And they had a study group on taxes, and they asked me to speak because I'd been offering myself as a speaker, and they were looking for a free speaker, and I was on that list, and so I said, sure, I'd be happy to talk about taxes, but I don't really know much about taxes, except two things I know is that they're too high and I'm against them. Other than that, what can I say? But I said, I might have something of interest to the ladies on the topic of a hidden tax. And so she said, well, what is a hidden tax? I said, well, it might be called inflation. Maybe it's a tax that you don't even know you're paying because you don't know who's getting your money. Oh, that sounds interesting, she said. So I went and pulled up my boxes out of the closet, went through them, and it blew my mind because I had forgotten all of that. Uh-huh. And initially, the process was slow and incremental, but this time it was all compressed, and I got the whole picture for the first time. It was like years later.
Maybe
I got
slept
the whole
on it,
picture.
It,
yeah.
It gelled,
it just,
and there was.
Oh, it just scared me to death. I thought, what have I got here? Uh-huh. So I put together the presentation, cobbled it together, and it was well received. And they said, well, that was great, Ed. You ought to put that on the road. Well, that's the one thing you should never say to a blooming public speaker, because you will put it on the road, which I did. I said, oh, that's good. I'm glad you liked it. So I polished it up, and I put it on the road. I started to give, interestingly enough, I called my one-day seminar, a crash course on money. Yes, I thought you might find that interesting.
I find that pretty interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, that was it. And I did that for about a year, year and a half, and it was very successful. But suddenly, not suddenly, but toward the end of that period, I became aware of my total inadequacy to present myself as an expert on this. I knew a lot about the Federal Reserve by that time, But at the end of these seminars, people would approach me and they'd say, well, Mr. Griffin, I trust you. What do you think I should do? I mean, I only have a little bit of money. My husband died, and I don't know whether I should get out of debt or whether I should sell the apartment building I have because I have a lot of debt on it. What should I do? And I'm looking at these poor people, and I think, you're asking the wrong person. I haven't the foggiest idea what you should do. And so I stopped the seminars, and I went to school. I enrolled in the College for Financial Planning in Denver. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be a financial planner, but I wanted to be literate in the real world of money and money markets. So I got my certificate, and I learned about these things. And then I got serious about producing the book. And then it was 7 years following that of more research, and the bloody thing came out the other end. So it was a long journey, and I can tell you that had I known at the beginning how long it was, how convoluted it was, and how difficult it would be, I would never have started.
Like all good projects. Like,
yeah, this is not unique at all, I've discovered. But there were several points, Chris, where I gave the project up. Mm-hmm. I thought, this is too big for me. I'm just a boy from Detroit, you know. I never went to school or learned anything about money or banking, and this is too big. And anyway, my conscience got to me, and I went back to it again. So that's the story. That's how I got from there to here.
All right, so fantastic story. I'm so glad to have heard that. Fifth edition of The Creature from Jekyll Island. What would you consider to be qualified pushback? Like, has anybody come forward and said, here's where you have this story wrong. Let us set you straight on this.
Interesting question. The short answer is no. And that's amazing, because I thought when I finished this that I was about to commit author suicide, to take on a topic for which I was so ill-trained, such a complex topic, and one which I knew was highly controversial, and to produce a document which was offered as the authoritative topic, in the dealing of the topic, but man, some college professor or some banker is going to get hold of this and they're going to crucify me publicly, you know? I got it wrong, you know? And so I timidly put it forward and I was waiting for the avalanche to come. And it never came. It never came. And I couldn't believe that. And finally, it was confirmed in my mind that I probably accidentally got it right. I was on a radio show back on the East Coast. I've forgotten what show it was, but I was invited to talk about the Fed, and when I got to the studio, to my surprise, they had a college professor there from a local university. So it wasn't just an interview, it was a debate. I didn't know that. I would have gone anyway, but I was scared to debate with a professor, you know, a professor of banking and money, because I knew that these guys had a lot of information. And so, anyway, the program starts, and he gave his spiel about, you know, the necessity for flexible currencies and all of, you know, the usual things, how the Federal Reserve is a benefactor of mankind and protects the monetary system, et cetera, et cetera. Then it was my turn to speak, and I just sort of blurted it out, you know. I said, no, that's not quite the way it turns out. Here's what I found out. And then I thought, well, here's where the fun begins after that. And it was back to the professor again. And now this is what you're going to enjoy hearing. I thought, here it comes. And he says, well, what you say is true, but we're living well, aren't we? I thought, is that the best he could come up with? We're living well because he is living well, and the benefactors of the system are living well, and everybody on government grants are living well, and and in the academic world are living well, but the poor people on the streets who are contributing unknowingly all this money to that little narrow group are not living so well anymore. I thought, so what he really was saying, since some of us are living well on the system, who cares whether there's plunder involved?
Well, and as you know, we have this other overlay, which is you can put a plunder system like this in place as long as resources are there to sort of plunder, and we're at this awkward time in human history when oil is getting expensive and will someday run out. And so we're going to discover this system that everybody's been reasonably happy with because it was enough plunder to share. There isn't anymore, And the system also, in an accelerating fashion, pulls it towards the top. And that's why we have 8 people in the world who have as much, air quote time, wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion people in the world. 8. Yeah, so that's astonishing. I raised that earlier question about the pushback you got. And by the way, I have a sort of a similar story. My mom had invited me to talk to her Quaker group. This is 2009. The Crash Course had come out. And I was giving them the basic talk about how money is created. And this guy stands up in the back. He's a retired professor of economics and just yelled, "I've taught economics for 30 years at UConn, and you have money creation all wrong." And he just went on and on. I just let him calm down. And I waited, and I said, "Well, if I have it wrong," and they reached behind me, I pulled out a comic book. The Federal Reserve creates comic books.
Oh, yes.
Did you know those?
Yes, yeah.
And I said, "You're going to have to take it up with these guys, because everything I just told you about money creation I got from the Federal Reserve, and it's in comic book form. Perhaps you'll find this useful."
Right? Maybe you might understand it.
So a year later, I heard from him, mm-hmm. and he apologized, and he said, "I had no idea."
Yeah, that's true. These people are not bad people at the rank and file level. But they're terribly misinformed. They've been through the educational system. I mean, they've been indoctrinated into a certain narrow point of view. So I've had that happen. I had one occasion where after one of my presentations, the host had a dinner for the sponsors of the event. And, of course, I was in the middle of this. And I sat next to a guy who is a bank auditor, okay. And he finally got around and said, "Well, you know," he said, "you don't really understand the complexities of how money comes in. Money is not really just created at all," he says, "because you can't just create something for every asset. You have to have a liability." I said, "Well, I know that, but they create them both at the same time." "Oh, no, they don't do that." "No," he says, "I audit the books. This is my business, you know." I said, "Well, I guess we've been reading different comic books." And anyway, make the long story short, a week later, I got a letter from this guy. He says, "You know, you got me thinking." And I went back and I analyzed it. And he says, "Hate to admit it, but you were right." "No, we do make it out of nothing."
So here's why I went down this particular line of inquiry. So you write this book. It's super well researched. It's in its 5th edition. And there's been no substantive real pushback to say, "Here's how you have it all wrong." You and I have lots of experience where we've been able to open people's eyes and they go, "Oh, yeah, that is how it works, right?" Mm-hmm. Well, if you can bear this, I just want to read from your Wikipedia page for a second.
Oh, yes. I can bear it, but hardly.
So here's how the world is decided. I'm sure you've tried to change this, but the people who the editors at Wikipedia who've weighed in on your bio, here's the first few lines from how they're introducing you. G. Edward Griffin is an American far-right conspiracy theorist, author, lecturer, and filmmaker. He is author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, which promotes conspiracy theories about the motives behind the creation of the Federal Reserve System. And it goes on from there, and they use the word conspiracy several more times. You've got other lines of inquiry you've done around nutritional deficiencies and medical stuff, cancer, things like that, 9/11, all of that. But how is this possible that you have a book that nobody can have, that's been out for a long time, in its 5th edition, there's no qualified pushback against this, and somehow this is it's promoting conspiracy theories? What do we make of this?
Well, we make of this the fact that Wikipedia is vulnerable to outside influence by what they call trolls. Mm-hmm. That would be a good topic for somebody to write a book on. If I had time, I would love to do a book on Wikipedia. But it's another one of those things that aren't what they appear to be. Now, Wikipedia is fine on scientific information or mm-hmm. historical information, as long as it doesn't impact on the control mechanism of this elite that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, once you get into those areas, then Wikipedia becomes the lapdog of those forces. Because all of the major corporations, I think that's fair to say. I have to admit, though, I haven't checked all the major corporations to see if this is true, but I believe it is that all of the major corporations, especially those that are dealing with ideas and products that relate on this control mechanism, mm-hmm. I'm talking about money, I'm talking about health care and that kind of thing, they have full-time people contracted to monitor Wikipedia 24/7. There's always somebody from those corporations watching it. So the minute any entry is made touching on their sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. They immediately change it or correct it. And they have, because they've done that so often, and they're paid to do it, so they can devote their lives to it, they move up in rank and become editors because they do spend time doing it. And they become the ones who are the gatekeepers for the information on Wikipedia. I learned a lot about that because this was about 2 years ago. I was called on the phone by a lady, I won't mention her name right now, but I hope that I would like to have her participate in our Red Pill conference coming up. Mm-hmm. Talk about that later, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to have her come out publicly and identify what she told me. But anyway, she's an editor at Wikipedia. And she said, Mr. Griffin, she says, I'm an editor at Wikipedia. And she says, a friend of mine, another lady, and I have become involved. She says, I don't know if you know it or not, but we've become deeply involved in a controversy among the editors at Wikipedia. I said, really? And over what? She says, over you. Me? Why me? She said, well, she said, we didn't know anything about you, but we thought when we saw your biographical information, the way it was being changed, we thought it was curious. So we started to look into it, and we thought that it was very biased on the part of a small group of other editors in our organization. Mm-hmm. So we started to challenge it. And she said, if you're interested, she said, it's all on the internet. Most people don't know, but the challenging mechanism by which one editor challenges the other is all available if you know the codes to get into the back room. Ah. Yeah. So she gave me the codes. I said, my gosh, this is a roaring fight going on. And they're calling each other names and everything.
All right.
It was like a cat and dog fight over me. I thought, well, that's interesting. So anyway, she lost the battle. She and her friend were told that if they didn't drop this line of argument, they would no longer be on qualified as editors. So,
really? Yes. Their whole editorship was on the line.
Their whole thing was on the line because they weren't conforming with this powerful block that was there. So I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that, but that was a very eye-opening experience for me. I just had to back away from it because I have no control over it. I've never made an entry on Wikipedia for my biography. Mm-hmm. Everything that's up there was done by others.
Right.
And initially it was done by people who were favorably impressed by my work. Mm-hmm. And then the trolls saw that and they had to change it immediately. And what you read a moment ago is the result of that process.
So let's talk about that word conspiracy for a minute, because it's bandied about. It's usually a conversation stopper in America. Mm-hmm. Right? Somebody, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Done. Mm-hmm. That's somebody's way of saying we no longer have anything more to talk about.
Yeah, because you're crazy.
Because you're crazy.
Yeah.
Right? It's a way of marginalizing
your label. Yeah, your logical processes are seriously impaired.
Yes.
Because we know there are no conspiracies, right?
Right.
Well, that's the thing. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I try to avoid the word conspiracy for the reason you just mentioned. It's not necessary. But when you're called a conspiracy theorist, you can't avoid the word. You have to deal with it and confront it. So so I deal with the concept of conspiracy a lot. First of all, my reaction is that most major events of history have been the result of a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Conspiracy is the most common component of history that you can imagine. Everything, especially when the stakes are high, the mm-hmm. higher the stakes are, the more motivation there is for groups to band together and conspire together to deceive and overpower their opponents so that they can have access to the spoils. This is the motivation for conspiracy usually. Mm-hmm. So if anybody that says that they laugh at conspiracies, oh, there's no conspiracies, I feel sorry for them. Mm-hmm. Because it means they've never read a book. They've never read a history book, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And so anybody that can take the position that conspiracies are, it's absurd to think that they exist, they've never read a history book, they've never gone to a courtroom. You can go to any county courthouse and sit there as an observer, and I'm going to guess that maybe a quarter of these trials, I mean, not traffic court, but I mean, mm-hmm. they involve conspiracies of one kind or another. This is what the courts are full of, is trying cases of conspiracy. Yeah. And so conspiracy is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And the higher the stakes, like as in government, which means mm-hmm. high, the motivation is for conspiracies to exist. So then we come to have to deal with it somewhat logically. Well, what is a conspiracy? Most people don't really know.
So what's the definition?
Well, most dictionary definitions have certain components. They're not all in agreement, but they seem to agree on the fact that a conspiracy is when two or more people come together and they use methods of deceit and deception to achieve a goal which is unethical or illegal. Illegal or unethical. Those are the three things. Mm-hmm. And that's a conspiracy. All right, so we're talking about the Federal Reserve now. Now, we're not talking about the pharmaceutical industry and they're pushing drugs that they know are going to kill people, but they hide the information. Mm-hmm. We're not going there today. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's just talk about the Fed. Okay, is there two more people? Oh, yeah, there are two or more people. There's one down. Do they use methods of secrecy? Yep, they have secret meetings. They talk about that this is a closed meeting. We do things. You're not allowed to know. Yeah, of course, they don't talk about everything. Highly, highly mm-hmm. secret. And is the result, is it either unethical or illegal? Well, now that's where it gets interesting, because first of all, it's not illegal what they're doing, because these people write the laws. That's the reason they go into politics, uh-huh. is so they can write the laws so that what they want to do is legal.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's legal. What the Federal Reserve, they're plundering people legally. But what about this thing called unethical? Well, they would say their actions are very ethical because they're, you know, the propaganda is that the Federal Reserve is stabilizing the economy and preserving our purchasing power of the dollar. Ha ha, I mean, my gosh, anyway. So they say this is all ethical. They're doing it for the American people. But you and I, anybody else that's not on the receiving end of all this money flow that they have there, and we look at what they're actually doing, most of us would say, this is highly unethical. So even though they escape the definition of conspiracy according to their definition of ethics, I think most people, if they really understood what the Federal Reserve is doing, would say, that's unethical. And therefore, you have the definition of a conspiracy. Now, whether you, I don't insist anybody call it a conspiracy. I don't care what they call it. Just call it a group of people who know what they're doing and they're plundering us. And they're, actually, it's not so much a conspiracy anymore. They write about it mm-hmm. and so forth. It's all out in the open. So the word conspiracy has a great, has a very limited utility in this discussion.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just astonishing to me that, so first, my view is that the word conspiracy and then the term conspiracy theory has been a marketed product of probably, I think if we chase it back, the documents I've read said that the CIA first promoted that as a way to begin marginalizing people who were looking into JFK's assassination, mm-hmm. because they wanted a way to begin to take people and make them fringe. Mm-hmm. And so this began in the 60s, and they were doing this very the documents have come out where it's very coordinated, and they're working with the New York Times and the Washington Post and other outlets to begin inserting this theme, and it took off, and it's really to this day we're living with the product of that, which is it becomes the showstopper. But when we dig into it, so like when we look at what happened with the Clinton Foundation, for instance, where Saudi Arabia would give $25 million to the Clinton Foundation, and then, whoops, here came this arms deal, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To me, I see enough of those in a row, and I go, wow, there's enough smoke there for me to say this is highly unethical, illegal behavior that was happening in that particular case, because you would see quid pro quo, money for favors, right? That happens all the time.
Yeah.
So I remember there were a couple things that caught me. One was reading about, it was Wall Street Journal, and they're very rare articles that come out, but there was an article where a guy had been allowed into the trading floor of the Federal Reserve in the Eccles building. And this was Liberty Street, so this was New York. And he talked about how there were these people, these Fed staffers, who could pick up a phone, and there was only one person on the other end. It was one of those phones where there just goes a single line, and it would go to the J.P. Morgan trading floor. And they were trading bonds back and forth. So J.P. Morgan is right on the front end of all this information. Then you skip over to J.P. Morgan's 10Q profit and loss statement. And they say, oh, yeah, for no good reason, we had 200 trading days last year. We didn't lose money on any one of those days. We made money every single day. So they have a bat phone to the Federal Reserve, and they're making money on every single trade. So what I take from this is that when I see something like that where the Federal Reserve is busy buying stuff using money printed out of thin air, and the people on the other end of the phone like JP Morgan are turning in 100% win ratios and making air quote making millions and billions of dollars off of that. That feels unethical to me because that's different flow of information than I would have access to, and they are it's certainly, if we can't call it a conspiracy because people don't like that term, what else would we call that?
Plunder. Legalized plunder.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, so here's some speculation then. This has bothered me for a while. I'd love to get your perspective on this. So the markets have been going up and up and up, and we know that the Bank of Japan is buying and intervening directly in their equity markets and also other markets, and they do that specifically on down days. We know the Swiss National Bank, because they reported on their balance sheet, major holder of shares like Apple and other U.S. stocks, big name stocks. Federal Reserve, in theory, is not allowed to participate in the U.S. equity markets, but Superstorm Sandy comes along, and the New York Fed, in response to that, air quotes, said, oh, we have to make sure that we couldn't get caught by something like that again. We're just going to move these trading offices just somewhere else. So they moved them to Aurora, Illinois, which is where the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has all their servers. And the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is where we do puts, options, futures, highly leveraged vehicles that are specifically across commodities and equities. And that's it. Right? Well, bonds is part of that equity sphere, I'm thinking. So that's it. Bonds, equity, I mean, highly leveraged stuff. And the New York Federal Reserve just accidentally moved their stuff there. And meanwhile, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, I could pull it up, they have something called the Central Bank Incentive Program, the CBIP, where because central banks are such good customers of theirs, they've given them volume discounts, and this is on their website. So I'm sitting here squinting at it going, our markets mysteriously get rescued all the time whenever they have a little down day. Central banks have preferred incentive buying programs at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The New York Fed moved its offices to Aurora, Illinois, in theory to escape the next Superstorm Sandy.
Yeah.
How would you put those dots together?
Legalized plunder. Yeah, it's obvious, isn't it? I mean, these things don't happen accidentally. And it's always to the benefit of a certain group of people, yeah. You know. And the idea that the Fed has got a line directly to a bank, let's just, whether it's Morgan, Chase, or whatever, this is not cross-pollinating at all because the Fed is the bank. See, this is the thing that threw me in the beginning because I thought, well, how does the Fed affect the banks? And I realized, oh, wait a minute, the Fed is the banks. It is a cartel of banks. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a nerve center for, it's like a trade union for banks. It's a way of simplifying it.
Okay, that's a good way to look at it.
So when the Fed, which is the bank cartel, calls one of the banks, it's just calling itself another department of itself. It's a unity operation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another hard thing to get around in your mind because it's so different from the way we perceived it originally.
Right. Right. Well, we could go on and on about the Fed, and of course I will later, but in the interest of this recording, I'm noticing that you have a really interesting conference coming up. The Red Pill Expo. Have you ever put anything on like this before?
Never before. This is an exciting new experience for us. And we're talking about the illusion versus the reality in banking.
Uh-huh.
You know, the thing that motivated us to do that is that we find that dichotomy, illusion versus reality, everywhere you look in the world today. And the more important aspect it is in our lives, it seems like the more likely it is that there's going to be illusion there rather than reality. So we thought we'd bring all of these areas together because everybody's taken a red pill of mm-hmm. some kind. Not everybody, but the kind of people we like to talk to, at least.
The interesting ones.
The interesting ones. Yeah. So we thought we'd provide this meeting place, this central place, this big umbrella to bring everybody together and talk about the red pills that they know about.
Well, and so this is we'll put a link to this, of course, at the bottom of the podcast, but this is June 23rd and 24th in Bozeman, Montana. Why Montana?
Bozeman, Montana, yeah. Well, first of all, we were interested in it because it was less expensive than mm-hmm. the usual convention centers like Las Vegas or Atlanta and so forth. And but then it turns out that it's kind of a tourist attraction, especially in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a narrow window of good weather, but that happens to be right in the middle of it. And so it's a beautiful place, and it's sort of out of the usual hectic distractions that you find in the big city. And a lot of people want to go there to spend their summer vacation. And they're bringing their kids with them. They're bringing the RV with them. And they're going to go visit the national parks on the way and so forth. So it turns out to be a very good move for us.
All right. And for those very few of you who don't know, Red Pill is an allegorical reference to the sci-fi movie The Matrix, which, of course, I reference all the time myself. And the Red Pill, when you take that, you begin to see reality in the life you're actually in. And so you're building this as an expo that gives the awakened ones a chance to meet each other and to realize they're not alone, to develop ways to network and help each other, to form a coalition, to discover who exactly their controllers are, and finally to participate in activities that will dismantle the Matrix. So this is something we do. One of the biggest values of the seminars that we hold, and we're just about to do one coming up at Roe, is honestly the value is just getting the people together. Yes. So they can talk to themselves and go, oh, I'm not nuts, right?
Yeah. It's amazing what networking can accomplish. And the internet is great, but it can't replace that face-to-face contact. I mean, the kind of relationship that is being developed here on board this ship.
Right.
My having a chance to meet you and Adam over there. And real people. We talk and we remember how our eyes look when ideas come across our mind and so forth. And so it creates a bond, really. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing one of the things I believe that's been missing from what I like to call the freedom movement, you know, is that we think we can just publish stuff on the internet and it'll somehow solve the problem. No. We have to get together. We have to become unified. That doesn't mean we all have to agree on everything, but we all need to help each other. And there is this common denominator in all of these movements, all these red pills that are out there. The common denominator is that the illusion is being enforced upon us by the state. We talked about plunder, and I add the word legal. It's that word legalized. That's the element that makes it so bad in all of these areas. I mean, vaccinations, you could argue whether they're good or bad, but when you have forced vaccinations, now we have a different animal. You can't escape it. Your judgment is short-circuited. The state is now telling you what to do. And everywhere you look, you know, in schools and medical services and in banking and money, communications, even freedom of speech, everything is becoming enforced by laws, and you have to comply and be regimented. And this is the common denominator, I think, if we find all of our red pill folks to realize that this is our common bond, and we have to break that matrix right there, get the coercion out of it.
You know, that our good friend Jim Kunstler, who I'm sure you're aware of, the author, he calls everything's a racket, you know, and so we dismantle the healthcare racket quite a lot. Adam and I both decoupled from the toxic food industry, which I'd grown up on and ate. I was really falling apart at one point. It was a few years ago, much heavier and really starting to feel my joints were all inflamed and aching. And I thought I'm getting older, which is true, but that was my excuse. And then I went to a naturopath, got a few blood tests, very simple, and discovered, oh, I'm eating foods that are inflaming me. My body's fighting them. It doesn't have energy left over to do anything else, but in the fighting, it's also attacking my cartilage and my tendons. So cut a few foods out, and wow, what a difference in my life, right? How does it come to be that I have to personally undergo a pretty interesting avenue of inquiry to find that? Because I can't find that information at my doctor's. I'm not going to find it from the USDA or the FDA or the EPA. You know, none of that information was available to me through what we would call traditional sources. Never taught about it in school. Almost every doctor I've talked to, MD, said, was nutrition a required part of your training? And they're like, no, it was an elective, or no, we didn't even have it, right?
Right.
And it is the foundation of all health, right?
Yeah,
so,
right.
So it's just everything, but it's such a, this is why I think it's fabulous to have a conference like this, because people, once you wake up, you realize we're surrounded by rackets.
Well, there's rackets, so that's a better word than conspiracy, isn't it? But it is a racket, of course. Yeah, if you can trick people into to using your product or your service and it's a non-competitive price, what better racket is there than that? And of course, that's the whole pharmaceutical field, right?
Yeah.
And now the element of coercion is added to it so that you are not allowed by law, you're not allowed to use certain therapies that we know are highly effective. And now you're not even allowed to speak against the established therapies. Freedom of speech is now infringed upon in the health field.
Yeah.
Up in Northern California, as you probably know, the legislature there, just the local legislature, passed a law that the school books, if there was any mention in the school books that questioned the validity of vaccines, they were to be removed from the schools. Yeah. In other words, it's illegal to even question a scientific issue.
Mm-hmm.
They want to make it illegal to question man-made global warming. I mean, you go to prison now if you say, I don't believe that. I think it's bunk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go to prison, and that's what they're working toward. So we're back to that element of coercion and force in every aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
And this is the common denominator that we hope people will see at the Red Pill Expo.
Well, fantastic. And, of course, you'll be there. And I see some other names on here I recognize. We've got James Corbett. He's an interesting guy. Cynthia McKinney, very interesting. Joel Salatin, friend of ours. Robert Kiyosaki will be there. Lord Monckton, Patrick Wood, very interesting people. And so, what do you hope? Like, you'll have a bunch of obviously fascinating speakers and more TBD. But tell us, how's it going to be structured? How are you going to run this one?
Well, that's an embarrassing question because we're still struggling with that. I think that the key is not too highly organized.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be flexible because one of our objectives is to allow people to network with each other. So if you have a highly structured program, you know, we'll be there in 5 minutes and no time to talk or anything, you've defeated your purpose, I think. So our structure is going to be fairly loose. We have a lot of off time between speakers. And a lot of time to go visit the exhibits, a lot of time to go in and get a cup of coffee and sit down and talk, and whatever else they want to imbibe with. It's not a heavy drinking group, I can tell you that, but there'll be some people who like their cocktails, that's fine.
Uh-huh.
So our real objective is to keep it loose so that there's plenty of time for everyone there to meet everyone else there that interests them. And we want the participants to be a part of the program actively rather than just passively listening to somebody.
That makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. So you've got that going on. What else is going on in your life? What are you working on?
Well, thank you for that question. Let's see. Let me count the ways. Well, Freedom Force is the organization that I founded some years ago. And we just finished in December of last year, we finished a conference. You're going to love this. The title of the conference is Global Warming, An Inconvenient Lie.
Hmm.
Okay. Any questions about the theme of that one? You know, it's pretty clear. We did our best to assemble the scientists, the journalists, the researchers to completely disprove without a shadow of a doubt that this theory of man-made global warming is complete bunk. What's your word for it?
It's a racket.
A racket. That's it. It's a racket. I wish we had used that word. It is a racket. It's a political racket to scare everybody into meekly accepting carbon taxes, more government rules and regulations. They just passively say, well, we got to save the planet, so whatever you guys want to do to us, I guess it's okay. That's what the racket is. And I think we knocked it out of the ballpark. And we recorded it, and as a matter of fact, next week we'll be delivering, or maybe 10 days from now, we'll be delivering the DVD set on that. So and we'll be broadcasting it, by the way, on the internet free. So it's not just about the money. Of course, we got to pay the bills, like every operation.
Sure.
But we will have it broadcast for a week long on the internet. And so if anybody wants to know the time and the date of the broadcast, just drop me a line and my email. Let's see, which one shall I use? The one that would be the best one will be, GEG@freedomforceinternational.org.
Okay, GEG@freedomforceinternational.org.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
GEG, those are my initials.
Got it. And so, was this a fact based tour?
A what?
This dismantling, looking at global warming, was this fact-based?
Oh, absolutely fact-based, yes. It's very scientific.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's not, we were talking about the simplest concepts. They're difficult because they are so simple. we're expecting it to be more complicated, and we don't. We say, no, that can't be that simple. But it turns out to be true in this case of global warming as well. Let me just give you one little factoid here.
Okay.
We're all worried about CO2, right? Carbon dioxide. Oh, that's the killer. Well, it turns out the scientific evidence is as clear as the nose on my face that CO2 is a life-supporting gas, and we'd all be dead without it. And as a matter of fact, historically, and when they go back over a million years, you can tell what the content was by looking at the fossils and so forth. We are now at the lowest level of CO2 in the environment that we have ever been. Actually, it's dangerous. We need more CO2 in the atmosphere now, because we're pushing the threshold of maybe human life and animal life is going to become ill because we don't have enough CO2 in the system. So, and this was shocking to me. I said, that can't be true, you know? Well, it is true. And the evidence is there. They've known about it. It's in the textbooks, really, if you want to go back and look at it. So that's just one little thing. For example, we have college professors talking about this. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a professor that came from, that's at the University of Canada, one from Princeton. I mean, we have a scientist, astrophysicist, scientist that works in that field all the time. And these guys are top of the class.
They must have been taking some professional risk, though.
They all are taking professional
to
risks.
To attend
yes.
this, right?
They did, and they're right up front about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We have a climate change thread on our site, which is we've got people both for and against, and it's really well moderated. It's one of the few places I've seen on the web where it's pretty fact-based, and people are going back and forth. Mm-hmm. And every so often we'll have somebody comes in with belief-oriented material, which mm-hmm. we don't allow. We don't do belief-oriented mm-hmm. on our site. You know, if you either believe one way or the other, that's not helpful to this conversation. But if you can bring your facts, what are they? Mm-hmm. Because that's how science actually advances.
Of course, yeah.
You know, that's how we learn things. Is
yeah, and so isn't it interesting then when politicians start passing laws and saying, you just keep your facts to yourself because they lead to the wrong conclusion, and we know that that's a wrong conclusion. So any facts that you bring are not allowed. You know? So the belief system then overrides the fact system.
Yeah. All right, so you've got Freedom Force, and you working on any books right now?
Well, yes, I always have been working on a book, it seems like. And the next one I'd like to finish soon, I hope, is An Idea Whose Time Has Come. And that'll be about Freedom Force International.
Mm-hmm.
And the theme there really is that we talk about all these problems, but what's the solution? If you don't have a solution, mm-hmm. and I'm here to tell you, the solution is not write your congressman, because half the time your congressman is part of the problem. The solution, really, if you want to cut to that, is replace your congressman. Don't write to him. He's already lost.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to break the system up so that the puppets of the controlling groups are no longer in positions of power. As long as they're in positions of power, we cannot turn this around. So that's one of the reasons that Freedom Force has a couple of interesting mottos. The official motto of Freedom Force is in Latin, and it's Impotentes defendere libertatem non possunt. Well, that translates into, those without power cannot defend freedom. A very important concept in the freedom movement that's been missing up until now. And the reason it's been missing is because we don't like power. We're opposed to power. But so that leads to the dilemma, how do you replace power if you don't have power? Well, there's a philosophical answer to that. It's that the idea of truth itself will overcome power. That's kind of not true. Maybe in 1,000 years it will,
mm-hmm.
but in your lifetime and mine, it probably won't, because the forces of evil, the forces of deception, can acquire control of the state mechanisms and by law make truth illegal. And we're back to that theme again. That's the problem we're facing right now.
Well, they only do that as a last desperate act.
So the unpleasant fact is that truth does not prevail just because it's true. It needs defenders. It needs people who will speak the truth and proclaim the truth. and who will actually get up off their couches and go out and promote the truth. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing that's been missing. We think, well, we're on the side of truth. The Lord will take care of us, you know. Well, maybe in heaven and all of that, but how about on this earth and for our children and grandchildren while they're on this planet? These are philosophical issues. Most people wind up with the same conclusion that I have, and that is that we all have this drive, this motivation, this instinct, if you will, to be on the side of virtue and truth. No matter how we might define that differently, mm-hmm. we want to do what is right. We have that built-in desire. And so if that's built into us, it's probably put into us by whatever force created us. Mm. And so I have come to the conclusion that whatever I'm supposed to be doing in this world, I'm probably doing it because I can't do anything else. I'm driven to do it. Yeah. So I don't have to waste too much time trying to analyze it, although I do waste a lot of time trying to analyze it. But I just better do what my impulses are.
Yeah.
And my impulse is to be on the side of truth. And that means I have to not just sit by and wait for it to happen and say, gee, I wonder how this is going to turn out. We have to become active and real defenders and crusaders for truth.
I totally agree. And what Adam and I have been up to is that truth alone is insufficient. Well, for a very small select crew of people, but I'm going to call them a percent or less, are capable of hearing and sorting through. Everybody else, there's a process that's to become an effective communicator of these things that we've had to learn about, which is that most people make their decisions and on basis of beliefs. And so really getting new truth in is a process of dismantling old belief systems. I think Niels Bohr talked about this in the science realm, saying that science advances one funeral at a time, meaning, you know, for the scientists who are entrenched in their way of seeing the world, like it was impossible for them to reconstruct their belief systems after a certain point, after they'd invested so much in. And so that's the point. We're really up against very entrenched interests. They have a lot invested in things remaining hidden, things going in a certain direction. But as you and I know, this direction we're heading in is a really bad one, not just for individuals, but collectively, I think, for everybody. This is not a good direction to be going in, so we have to break through somehow and figure out how do we reframe this so we can wake up to the fact that all these rackets are running. They're not good for us. They make us sick, fat, and unhappy, and all of those other things. But besides which, we're really heading in a direction of really killing the planet overall, and that's the way I look at it, with consuming resources and looking at species loss and things like that. That's where I get my motivation is, not only can we do better, but we really need to.
And we will, because that's a drive. I'm back to that. You and I are driven by this. Mm-hmm. And I think most people are. Once they hear the sound, once they hear the chord, they'll mm-hmm. say, that's the chord I've been waiting for, you know?
Yep.
And so it's our job to bang the gong, let them hear the chord, hear the sound, and I think most people will respond to it.
And more are. And so I'm going to take this moment to thank you for coming first and for having been hitting on that gong for a very long time. And without your work, so many people, myself included, I don't think would be here to carry that and pick that up. So
thank you so much for
what you've done through all this time.
Well, onward and upward.
Very good. Well, Ed, thank you so much
for your time today. My pleasure.
Wonderful interview. And hope we can do it again sometime.
Well, we'll see you at the Red Pill Expo.
Fantastic.